Barbara, who came. We've got big things to talk about here on Take Back, and we have an agenda. As our planet faces global climate change, melting polar ice caps, and ocean acidification, we like to remain positive. There's hope. We're still alive. Here at Take Back, we try to get deep into understanding these issues and ask big questions about what does it mean to be human and where are we going wrong on planet Earth. Here on Take Back, we have thinkers, poets, writers, educators, musicians, and environmentalists, as well as risk takers, help us get it right and navigate this crazy journey called life. Maybe we'll get inspired to make some big changes and ask a very good question: who have we been and why? Today on our show, we're going to talk about media, radio journalism, and what does it take to get the story right. Jason Bogan is the Global Health and Development Correspondent with National Public Radio. He reports on a range of health issues across the world, often putting personal safety at risk. He's covered stories about mass circumcision drives in Kenya, poisonous gold mines in Nigeria, climate change issues for farmers in Madagascar, and so much more. His team of reporters at NPR won a Peabody Award in 2015, and we are so lucky to have Jason by phone from Washington, D.C. Hi, Jason. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Good to be with you, Barbara.
This is so fantastic. Full disclosure here, I do have to say I met Jason, I think it's been about 20 years ago when you were at KQED and I was a pigtailed intern following you around for your stories. And I realized at that point in time what it takes to be a journalist for public radio. And I was so inspired at the time. I think I lasted for about 2 years and I thought, boy, you guys are really smart people. I'm not sure I can keep up. Tell me, what have you been up to, and what's keeping you in the game of journalism these days?
Well, you know, the great thing about journalism is that you don't dive into a story unless there's something interesting there, something that sort of piques your interest, that makes you want to find out more about it. And as somebody who's, you know, very curious about the world, it's a great field to be in because you can jump in, try to figure something out, try to tell stories. It's kept me very engaged and sort of excited about the world for, a couple of decades now. So I'm very happy that this is where I ended up as a journalist.
Now, I remember back in the KQED San Francisco days, that must have been in your early journalism career, I was following you around to the board meetings, city board meetings, and other local news. And I remember you had a drive to you. I mean, you really wanted to get things right. And that's why I'm so happy you're on the show, because, I mean, I'll tell you, you've been one of my biggest fans because I've been able to follow your career all these years on the radio, although I haven't talked to you in about 20 years. But I remember at that time the drive that you had to have in order to be there and talk to the right people and, you know, really come from that deep place from what I saw of, you know, why you want to get the story right. And what's your background? How did you get involved in journalism?
I mean, I was a English major at San Francisco State, and I really, very honestly, did not know what I was going to do with my life. I liked literature. I liked creative writing. I had traveled a bit. Worked in different fields, and I was wrapping up my time at San Francisco State, and I started doing some internships, and one of them was at KQED, and they sort of sent me out with a microphone to go get some vox, as they call it, just some interviews with people on the street about, I don't even remember what it was about at this point, and I just loved it. I loved talking to people and hearing their opinions and listening back to the tape and trying to find the voices that really sort of conveyed what we're hearing overall from people. And after that internship, I freelanced a bit at KQED, and eventually they hired me, and I've sort of been doing public radio ever since. So that was my road into this career.
And and you left KQED. How long have you been with NPR? Because that was a pretty big move, going from the West Coast to the East Coast, as you did.
Yeah, so I was at KQED, then I went to WBUR in Boston for a few years, and then it was in 2002 that I officially was hired by the national network, and I got hired as the Africa correspondent at that point, based out of Johannesburg, which was a little bit of a leap going from being a sort of a general assignment reporter at WBUR in Boston, just covering stuff around Boston, so covering a whole continent. And that was, yeah, probably one of the most scary moments of my career, to sort of dive into that and not know whether I would be able to succeed or not. But yeah, it was a great 4 years in Africa, traveled all over, did some fascinating stories, met incredible people, and it was good. So that was how I first got into the network, and then I went from there to Mexico. I was in Mexico for a few years, and then eventually came back to Washington to cover global health, based out of sort of the mothership at NPR.
Right, right. And I'm sure this is really given you a big perspective of what's going on in the world, right? I mean, really being able to talk to the people, get so close to the stories. How has this shaped you as a person, or has it reshaped you in any aspects?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think one of the problems we have as Americans, as U.S. citizens, is oftentimes a lack of recognition of how big a world there is outside of us, and how different a lot of people's lives are, you know, from ours. There's, you know, billions of people in the world who are struggling to live at the poverty line or just above it, and you know, their everyday concerns often are just about the basics, you know, getting enough money to get enough food, get enough water. You know, we're not talking about luxuries. We're talking about just covering the basics. And there's a lot of people in the world who live that way. So it definitely always makes me appreciate just, you know, in a way, how even luxurious our lives can seem here in the U.S. So it certainly gave me a perspective on some of the global inequality that exists at the moment. And that's something I try to highlight in my reporting, to try to bring my audience in on that, let them at least, you know, hear a bit about what life is like in some of these other parts of the world, so that hopefully there's a bit more understanding. I think that's probably the biggest thing that has come from so much of my traveling. Yeah.
Perhaps a sense of humility is what I'm hearing. One of your stories, more people living as refugees now than any time since World War II, New N report says. This is a report that you gave, I guess it was last month. Oh, no, August. In August, you wrote this.
Yeah.
I mean, the world is shifting in such a high level right now. I mean, you're out there giving us these stories and shaping the way that we see the world. That's a pretty big responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I certainly feel an obligation to try to increase understanding in the world, you know, in understanding both ways. I mean, I certainly think I can have more of an impact on our audience in the U.S. because we have this huge megaphone called the radio that just, you know, blasts these stories out. But also when I'm traveling, trying to, let people understand a bit more what an American is, you know, what somebody from the U.S. is like. You know, there's certainly tons of, I was in Colombia just, I don't know, a few weeks ago, and people there are very concerned about the current U.S. president, you know, and they want to want to know, you know, what people in the U.S. think about the way he's dealing with North Korea and things like that. So I try to also be a bit of a bridge in the other direction as well, and talk with people, and I enjoy doing that too. So I feel blessed in a way that I got a chance to do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of us Americans are trying to figure out what an American is too right now. I mean, there's so much going on right now with even the discussion of what is news, what is fake news. Everyone, it feels like there's a big shift happening, even with culturally within our country here, of course. And so much of that is based on the way we look at news and look at information, look at stories. I mean, stories are what shape us. What are your thoughts about this whole fake news business that are being, you know, being thrown around? I mean, what is news anymore? I mean, how do you answer that?
Yeah, I think definitely, you know, there's been a huge change. I mean, social media has upended the traditional news business. At the same time, I think that having so many stories out there on your news feed and, you know, coming at you, I think sometimes it can be really hard to even process it. So I think one of the things that we can do as NPR is to try to make it really clear that if you see that something was on NPR's website, you can expect that it is at a certain level of quality, right? That you can, you know, we hope you can trust that those quotes that are in there are true, right? And, you know, for us, more than ever, it's important to us that when we are broadcasting things or putting things up on our website, that we are upholding an incredibly high standard, because as soon as people start questioning whether you have integrity or not as a news organization, you're in deep trouble. You know, you become just one of these other voices that's out there that could be saying absolutely anything. It's kind of amazing. I mean, it's almost like if you wanted to find a story saying a particular thing these days, you can find it. And if not, you can create it yourself and stick it up on a website somewhere, and it'll look like it's the truth. So we are actually in an incredibly both lucky but sort of, there's a burden of responsibility on us as well, of our past reputation, our current reputation, and our future reputation, that all of that is on the line almost with every story. So there's a lot more pressure to make sure that things are right. And yeah, I mean, part of the problem with fake news is how quickly it can take hold and can spread these days, with the social media and with other, you know, just sending stuff around on email. Something that isn't true can take hold quite quickly. And so
certainly when there's fear generating and uncertainty generating, which I know, I'm going to just speak just right now in San Rafael, north of us, we had the recent fires in Santa Rosa. I mean, just really 30 minutes from where I'm sitting right now. I mean, tremendous fires. And I was actually thinking of you Monday, because I went up there. I do a little television program with Public Access Television here, and we went to get some interviews and so forth. And, of course, the military police are up there. And they are so, they're very scary looking. How else do I put it? And I actually felt, as a journalist, they were questioning me and my integrity and were suspicious of me, you know? And here they are, my people, Americans. And I was thinking to myself, actually, at that moment, because I knew we were going to talk a few days later, is like, how does Jason deal with these feelings when he's in other places where clearly the stories he's getting are probably not the popular stories from those countries? When you're talking about mass circumcision and, you know, certain countries and whatnot, controversial for sure. And right. I felt nervous, and, you know, well, nervous is probably the right word, when I was confronting these military police who were scanning me up and down. It really gave me perspective for your line of work, you know, being outside of a safety zone.
Yeah, I mean, I try to keep as low profile as I can in these foreign countries, and, you know, oftentimes if you are ending up getting confronted by security forces, it's probably not going to be good. You know, there's certainly, in a lot of places in the world, feel quite comfortable just, you know, taking your notebooks, taking your equipment.
Has that happened to you?
Yeah, it's happened. It's happened at times. I was arrested one time in Zimbabwe during I was there during the midst of a food crisis, and me and this other reporter and a photographer were hearing that, well, actually, you know, there is a lot of grain still at the silos, but they're just not distributing it. And so we said, well, we'll go stop by and have a look, right?
Yeah.
People were not happy about that. And we were arrested, and they took our gear and our notebooks. And, something like that could also happen in the U.S., but it's less likely to, I think. You don't have the First Amendment when you're working abroad, right? You just don't have it. So it's one of the great things. I mean, other countries, there are places that do have laws that are supporting freedom of the press, but it is kind of a great thing about the United States is that it's the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights. It just gives it extra weight, and it can be difficult working abroad. And as I said, I do just, for the most part, I try to avoid confrontation as much as possible. Sometimes that's just not possible when you're trying to figure something out, trying to really understand what is happening in a place. But
And certainly
Given
getting
that I'm
the
often
interviews
working alone, yeah.
Yeah, getting the interviews from the people who have the stories are often the people who are more at risk too in those places, right? I mean,
yeah.
And those are the voices that you want to get because they're powerful voices who
Absolutely. True.
Yeah. Well, do you feel that the First Amendment is being challenged in our country now? I mean, a lot of people think so. A lot of people are very nervous about speaking out. I know here in Marin County, there's a lot of fear, primarily because we are such a progressive community. With Brown recently challenging Trump on a lot of different issues, you're talking about fear and stories. There are a lot of stories that are percolating because of the fires up north after Trump had said, what did he say, just days before, that this is the calm before the storm. It is amazing to hear the conspiracy theories that are flying around right now, Jason, about those fires up north, because everybody said those fires were not normal. Everybody. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. And having had that experience on Monday, it's just kind of enlightened me to understand your work going into those kind of zones. I mean, this was different than what you do for sure. But where there's so much uncertainty, there's a lot of worry, there's a lot of fear, especially when you're dealing in countries that are very unstable.
Yeah, in places where people don't trust the government, which is also the case in the United States, I think a lot of people have a lot of mistrust in the government. Rumors can start flying, and it can make things very difficult as a journalist, because you can start getting, like, multiple people are telling you exactly the same thing, but they actually all are getting it from the same rumor mill, you know?
Yeah.
So that does become make things even more difficult, because you know, used to be that, you know, if you just get it verified by enough people, then, yeah, sure, this is true. But sometimes you have to say, well, is it possible that what we're hearing from all of these different people is simply the same rumor repeated multiple times? And so you have to sort of try to step back and go, so what is the factual basis to this? And it just makes our lives and our jobs that much more difficult. But, you know, I still think it's very important to do it and to try to get at, like, what is really happening. I mean, I haven't been covering that Rohingya refugee crisis out of Myanmar, but, you know, I think it's an example of where journalism really matters. You know, there are journalists on the ground there. They're interviewing these refugees as they're coming out. They're documenting, you know, do I want to use the word genocide at this point? I'm not sure whether, I think ethnic cleansing is definitely a valid term for what's happening there at the moment. But if it wasn't for journalists, those stories might not get documented, might not get captured, might not get told at all, because who knows what's going to happen to some of these people. I mean, you've got what appears to be security forces killing people, driving other people completely out of the country. If it wasn't for the press being there and letting the world know that, these people would be, I mean, eventually people obviously are already noticing that there's huge camps are developing across the border, but in Bangladesh, but it's there wouldn't be the understanding of this is happening right now, sort of under our watch in the world.
You're listening to Jason Beaubien. He's a correspondent with NPR. He's the Global Health and Development Correspondent with National Public Radio. He's joining us here at Take Back, Dominican Radio, 102.3 FM, or radio.dominican.edu worldwide. We're so lucky to have you here, Jason. Just really, you're so inspiring. What stories, how do you get sent off to the stories? What stories are you going to now? Why? How are those chosen for you, or do you choose them yourself? And what are the most important stories that we should be hearing right now?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of both in terms of how I get sent off on a story. Some of it's something that I want to work on. Some of it's, you know, something that has been percolating. Some of it's just things that need to get covered by the network. Next week, I'm heading to Puerto Rico to cover some of the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. This is kind of an amazing story. I haven't checked this morning, but as of yesterday, only 14% of electricity customers in Puerto Rico have had their electricity restored. This is 1 month after this storm hit. 14% with electricity. You know, these are American citizens, these are U.S. citizens. This is a part of the United States. If this was a state and this had happened, I kind of can't believe that 1 month later things would still be as bad as they are in Puerto Rico. And it's going to still take a long time to get that that island back to anywhere near normal. I'm heading down there next week, just to try to document what conditions are like, stay on top of the recovery efforts, as slow as they are. And I think that's a really important story at the moment, especially when you've got, you know, the president coming out and, I don't know, I guess it was last week he came out and said, oh, you know, FEMA can't stay there forever. You guys have to get back on your own feet. And, you know, FEMA is still helping out after Superstorm Sandy hit New Jersey. You know, what year was that? 2012? I mean, it's still working in parts of Louisiana from where Katrina hit. It's, you know, FEMA is going to be in Puerto Rico for a long time, not just a few weeks here. So, you know, I feel like it's important to be there and keep attention on a really fairly dire situation, you know, because people don't have access to clean water. You know, they don't have, obviously, electricity. There's parts of the island that are still sort of cut off. The roads haven't been opened up. So we'll be there and try to explain some of that while we're there.
Yeah, and it really doesn't feel like we're getting enough stories from Puerto Rico on a mainstream level. I have to dig for them, you know?
Yeah. And you know what's actually even crazier is that the U.S. Virgin Islands was hit just as bad, and we aren't even getting the stories out of there at all. I mean, the population is smaller than Puerto Rico. You know, we only have so many resources that we can deploy at any one point in time to all these various things in the world. And particularly these hurricanes have been incredibly taxing on our resources, with Harvey originally flooding Houston, then Irma smashing the Keys, and then Maria just basically decimating Puerto Rico. Just as a journalistic organization, you know, if it had just been Harvey and it hit Houston, we would be back there right now doing follow-ups on the incredibly difficult process of rebuilding for people there, dealing with flooded houses, dealing with insurance claims, dealing with, you know, do you move out of a flood zone, do you not move out of a flood zone. But we've been having to run from one thing to the next so that, you know, we aren't even doing on the level that we probably would have otherwise those stories. And in all of this, the U.S. Virgin Islands has kind of completely fallen through the cracks. I mean, we're aware of it. We would like to be getting more stuff out of there, but it's really hard to get in there now, and we're ending up deploying resources to Puerto Rico instead. I mean, it's just a little bit of an insight into the decisions that we need to be making about, okay, what story do we tell right now? And rarely is it perfect.
NFL stories can dominate the airwaves now? I'm not saying anything bad about that, but how is it that it can dominate these other real life tragedies where people are surviving? I mean, in Puerto Rico, for example, I mean, the stories I have seen, water is a major issue right now for many people, not just electricity, but clean water, drinking water, food, having cash to pay for things. I don't understand that. And that's been a problem in the United States for a while. I remember even when I was working at KQED with you, the stories that dominated the mainstream, the most part, to me, didn't seem as powerful as the stories that you guys were telling, you know, in public radio and certainly other media channels too. And I just wonder how did that all come about? Why do those stories somehow dominate the American psyche more? Seem more interesting? I don't understand.
I don't have the clear answer on that. But you know, we also NPR has also been covering the NFL stuff too. It just doesn't dominate our coverage, right? There's stories in there to try to, this is going on, this is what's happening, and it's part of this broader picture. But I do think that in our media world at the moment, at times things do just come to completely dominate one particular channel or one particular outlet in a way that's a bit odd, it seems like, yeah. But why actually that happens, I it would simply be speculation on my part. I mean, I do think that some of the channels like to, you know, like CNN, for instance, I think they like to feel like they're making a stand on one particular issue, and so they're really, you know, banging the drum on that one particular thing for a day or a week or whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So what do you think are the most important stories worldwide right now? I mean, climate change, I know you've written about. Is that what you think is one of the most important stories? What do you see as some of the most vital stories that people could get on board to understanding and listening to?
Well, I'm thinking of a big sort of, you know, round of applause to Nick Kristof from the New York Times for getting into North Korea last month. I don't think it's completely out of the range of possibilities that we could have a nuclear war. I mean, I think that understanding that threat and understanding how the risk of that has changed, you know, since Donald Trump became president, I think is a hugely important story. Do I think there's going to be a nuclear war tomorrow? No, I don't. But I think the risk of it has gone from being very, very minimal to being, yeah, it's out there now. I think these stories about the ultimate existence of human beings on this planet, I think those are, you know, really important. So I think that the potential for a catastrophic war, I think, is one. I think climate change is another. I think that overpopulation and so not just trying to think about, okay, what's happening in the next 100 years, but what's going to happen in the next 200 years. The projections for population growth on this planet are just staggering, and that gets no attention. So it's almost like, you know, we can be like thinking about, oh, nuclear war because we're going to die tomorrow. But I still think it would be pretty awful if the human race does end up kind of ending up wiping itself out because we overpopulated the planet, not tomorrow and not in my generation, but in, 100 years or 150 years. So I've tried to do some stories about some of that. And some people get a little touchy about overpopulation and feeling like it's an attempt to, you know, dictate family size to people in poor countries. People in poor countries tend to have a lot more kids. That's not the issue. The issue is that when you have more and more humans on the planet, we end up being more and more destructive. We end up using up more and more resources, and, you know, we need to be considering that there is a carrying capacity to this spaceship that we got here. And oftentimes that doesn't even get discussed. So, I mean, I feel like those issues are really important. I feel like global inequality is really important, because I also feel like that is likely, again, maybe not next year, maybe not in 10 years, but I cannot see how we can be pushing forward as a planet and have some parts of the world, you know, eating their filet mignon and living one lifestyle, and other people living a completely different lifestyle in which they're well aware that this other world exists over there. and that doesn't end up leading to incredible tension, probably war, at some point down the road. So I feel like dealing with global inequality is really important. There's not a whole lot of interest in that, I think, from the powers that be. And there's also not a lot of interest in it oftentimes just because everybody's just trying to, like, survive on a daily basis. But in the long-term, big picture, I think, I feel like that's one of the great threats that's out there that needs more attention. So, yeah, that, you know, when you ask me what are the biggest stories, one of the most important stories, I feel like ultimately it comes down to these stories about survival as a species, you know, like, is this whole thing just going to completely fall apart on us, or are we going to figure out a way to live that's actually sustainable long term?
Last week, I was on my way to a fundraiser for Puerto Rico in San Francisco, and as I was walking to the event, I happened to pass by loads of homeless people, and a woman in her wheelchair with no legs, she was probably about 75 years old, wheels up to me in her wheelchair and says, "It's my birthday today, do you have a dollar? You know, I'm just trying to get enough food just to do a little celebration today." And she was clearly, she was smiling, she was, you know, having a good day, I suppose, based on her circumstances, but I couldn't believe of the inequality that's happening in our own country. You know, I mean, it shocked me. I hadn't been in San Francisco for quite a while, especially in that area. Yeah. By the Mission, and it was just street after street of people. I mean, ragged people. I mean, really desperate people living on the streets. And it was just, you know, there seems to have, you know, a lot of things are happening in this country too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know vast inequality abroad, but how do the stories help us within our own communities?
Yeah, and obviously, you know, in the U.S., inequality is a huge issue as well. The interesting thing is, like, the part of the way that my work is broken down, it tends to be focused more internationally. But I completely agree with you. I think that the issue of inequality in this country as well is a completely destabilizing factor, and, you know, one of the issues that absolutely needs to get addressed. You know, if we want to have a stable, peaceful, prosperous nation, you know.
And certainly having the stories from abroad helps us give perspective to our country and what's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, whether we like it or not, the world has become globalized. And in a way, like, that horse is out of the barn. And you can have politicians calling for, you know, bringing back manufacturing and, you know, protectionist type of policies. And some of that might be good.
Yeah.
But in amongst all that debate, there are still all of those shipping containers showing up at American ports every day. And people are going into Walmart and Target and all these places and buying goods that were manufactured abroad. And if that system doesn't change, that whole infrastructure and logistics that's moving all of these goods from other parts of the world into our country, and our people continue, you know, buying them, that system is going to keep going no matter what politicians are saying about bringing back manufacturing or restructuring things to try to create more jobs in this country, in part because it's just much cheaper to manufacture shirts in Bangladesh.
But do you think that there's a higher level of responsibility we have being the consumers that we are? I'm going to point to we did a show with an NGO organization, what are they called? Skipping my mind right now. They deal with the chocolate industry in the Ivory Coast, an organization that came out of Greenpeace quite recently in the last year, and how incredible deforestation is happening in areas because of cocoa production, unethical, very abusive techniques where forests are being ripped apart, all in the name of chocolate, right? And we over here, we're buying up the stuff, especially if it's cheap, right?
Because
that's what we're being told to do. But I think ethically, most of us, if we understood what's really happening on that other side, we wouldn't be so inclined to be part of that. You know, whether it's, you know, a human rights abuse or ecological abuse, whatever it might be. I mean, there tends to be, like, we almost have a higher level of responsibility because right here, the money's here. And and we're driving a lot of that with our purchase power.
Yes, we are.
I know when I travel, I've done some traveling, and when I go to other countries, I see some of those truths. And for me, being an American, I feel like I want to be apologetic when I'm in those other countries. Do you see some of the, how do you deal with when you see those inequalities being an American? I mean, how do you cope with that?
Well, I think, I'll just tell you, like, gold and diamonds and, you know, this precious metals, like, I have no desire to have a diamond ring, to give anyone a diamond ring, to wear gold. After seeing the conditions that people go through to mine this stuff, in some of these countries, right? Like, you know, there's some places where this stuff is mined and it's mined by big machines or whatnot. But, you know, most places where gold is being produced outside of, you know, some large facilities, it's often really kind of exploitive work where people are ripping up the environment, working incredibly hard to try to get just a tiny bit of this precious metal, in the process often destroying what would be decent farmland, or, you know, at least the sides of rivers. And just personally, I have been put off of those products. And also on, but I also don't think it's, like, I've also seen places where, like, textile mills can bring in a lot of money and a lot of work to people who really want that, and that it actually, it's not great by an American standard, but it actually does help lift people up. Unfortunately, the textile industry tends to sort of race to the bottom when it comes to wages, and so they tend to work someplace, and then once people get used to a certain standard of living and start asking for more, then they tend to pack up and go somewhere else. But, you know, I have seen places where these types of jobs are very much welcomed and are an improvement over the no jobs that were there before. So it can leave me a bit conflicted at times, I have to say. I mean, I don't feel like I can come down absolutely and say, you know, this is absolutely terrible all the time.
And maybe it's just a level of integrity all through the line, through the middleman, through the consumer, and maybe that's where everything needs to reside. You know, that it's interesting what you're just saying. Referring to the fire at North, just because we're all affected by it. I mean, even looking outside, the air is still pretty murky out the window I'm looking at right now from the station. But You know, they're using prisoners now to put out the fires, and that's been pretty controversial. But the other side of the story too is, hey, you know, it gets these guys outdoors. They're getting $1 an hour, or the days reduced from their sentencing. You know, there's a lot of ways to look at it, and certainly that's what stories help us do, right? It just helps us look at different angles, different perspectives of a situation. It's funny, when I was at KQED with you, I was also doing some work at KPFA in Berkeley. And when I was at KPFA, they would say, the way that I was writing the stories, which I had been trained with KQED, that it was more right, let's call it that, spectrum. And then when I went to KQED, the perspective, now this is 20 years ago, KPFA was a little bit more left. And yet, when I talk to people in society, they think NPR is more left. So you have this, just talking about perception, right? You know, just different perceptions depending on where you're standing and how you're looking. And interestingly, one of the reasons is, I mentioned before having you on the show is that I had heard from some students, and it was really alarming to me as everyone's questioning what media is anymore, that NPR is more right-wing. And I almost fell on the floor laughing. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me, knowing what you guys go through, and you specifically go through in order to get stories, is how is it possible to develop that perception, you know? Because I think it's a false perception,
we get accused of being right wing. We get accused by other people of being left wing. And in a way, I kind of feel like we probably are doing things what I view as the correct way, if it's possible for some people to feel like we're too far to the left and some people feel like we're too far to the right.
Yeah.
I think hopefully we are sort of somewhere in the middle. I mean, I think that's what we shoot for. We certainly don't make, you know, we do not try to engage in that game in which particularly Fox News does of trying to stake out a particular spot on the political spectrum. I mean, that's not what we're trying to do. We really are focused on trying to explain these issues, explain these stories, trying to make sure that we took the various perspectives on this into account and present it in as fair a way as possible. You know, I think we have given up the idea that we are going to be 100% objective. I don't think we don't sort of try to make that claim, but we try to really look at these issues seriously, take them seriously, take the various stakeholders' perspectives on it seriously, and present what's happening. And at times, dig in to try to get more information and give people, some clarity through that. So I think in a time when, you know, as we talked earlier about, where there is a lot of fake news out there, I feel like it's almost more important than ever to be trying to do this work.
One little bit of history that I learned not too long ago was about the Fairness Doctrine, which was a policy for the FCC. It was introduced back in, I think, 1949 or 1950, that required journalists to present, you know, controversial issues, you know, both sides, right? And that got eliminated, actually, by Ronald Reagan in 1987, I want to say.
Yeah.
Which led to, you know, now to report news, you don't have to report both sides, right? And just wondered, what is your approach to that when you're out there getting a story? How do you try to, you know, present a story and try to find the voices? Do you try to get both sides? Do you, I mean, And I'm asking this, like, what would you tell new journalists coming in? We're at a school here. A lot of people are looking to become a journalist. What kind of advice would you give?
Yeah.
In giving and learning how to tell a story fairly.
Yeah, I would say to sort of step back and say, you know, who are the players in this? Who are the people who are impacted? Who are the people who have the power? Who's in control here? And who's being affected? And try to map that out, and then go talk to as many of them as you can, you know? And it may turn out that, this is the great thing about this job, it may turn out that the person you thought was sort of a minor person on the impact side of the story, you know, turns out to have a fascinating story about how they're being affected far more than you ever expected them to have been. So, you know, the one thing I think is I always really try to look at it completely from outside of myself, to the point where that's almost so completely second nature that it almost sounds a little strange to say it at the moment. I very much view what I do as telling other people's stories. And so I do think people have different roles in the world. Like, some people are activists, right? That's who they are, right? That's what they do. That's how they approach the world. That's how they sort of interact. Other people are, you know, business people or cooks or whatever. Some people are like ardent Republicans or ardent Democrats, you know, and they like take everything from along the party line. Like, I'm so much not that. I very much view myself as this sort of observer, this person who's just out there as an observer. And that's sort of what I see a journalist as doing, that you're an observer and you're there to try to see and to make sure that you see from as many perspectives as possible.
You're listening to Jason Beaubien, NPR correspondent, joining us today on Take Back. We've been talking about all sorts of things, right, Jason, about world issues and media in the United States, what it takes to be a journalist. What do you think it really takes to be a journalist in today's world? I mean, we've got a lot of things. There's so many fascinating stories happening right now, and many of us are talking about there being a big cultural shift happening in the United States, which to me, this spells an exciting time to be a journalist, because there's so many amazing things happening. I mean, in our country, but around the world, too. What would you say to that?
I think if you don't love doing it, if you don't have that innate curiosity, if you don't really want to figure these things out and understand it, this is too difficult a job unless you really love doing that, right? So, like, I think part of it is that you have to sort of have that drive and that curiosity and that desire. Otherwise, there's, you know, too many times that you're calling somebody up and being rejected and they won't talk to you or they're putting you off, or that it's, I think you end up giving up fairly quickly if you didn't have that drive and that desire to sort of illuminate what's happening in our world. So I kind of feel like that's the biggest thing that I think somebody needs if they want to be a successful journalist today.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us on this show. I admire what you're doing so much. And although I haven't talked to you in 20-something years, I feel like I've been able to keep up with you. And there were other journalists at the time at KQED. David Wright was another one who I know has gone on to do some great work as well. And I think back at those KQED days 20 years ago with Cy Musiker and Raul Ramirez, there were some other really great people, Michael Krasny. And I'll tell you, just being an intern and watching what you guys all did, it really shaped my life today, all these years, even though I hadn't really been in journalism for the last 15 years myself. But
that's great.
It's interesting how these kind of life experiences can really help shape you, even if you're not getting paid. I know you guys are getting paid the big bucks at NPR, right?
That's right.
I say that sarcastically, of course. I really admire you. Any parting words that you want to share?
No, it's been great to talk with you, and good luck with your show, and hopefully this is insightful for people, or at least interesting, and it's been a pleasure to be on with you.
Thank you so much. That was Jason Bovian. He's a correspondent with NPR. He reports on global health and development. And he's on his way to Puerto Rico later this week or early next week. So if you listen to NPR, you'll hear Jason Bovian. He was one of my early mentors, and I've just always admired him. So here back in Marin County, well, we've just had the big fires, as you know, up north. A lot of people have been asking, what can I do? What can I do for our neighbors in Sonoma County? I was there on Monday and just saw the devastation. I actually joined a family who went to their neighborhood to see if their house stood or not, and it did not. It was completely incinerated. It was a pretty emotional time for everybody, and that show is actually will be on CMCM television here in San Rafael. You can look at the information on my website, barbaramcveigh.com, for that video. If you want to do something for those folks, tonight from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Village at Corte Madera, State Senator Mike McGuire has set up a drive up and donate. Cash and checks are what they need. Also, a call out for thank you notes. You have no idea how a little bit of appreciation can go a long way for these teams who go out 24 hours at a time to battle these walls of fire, and that's what they have been calling this fire that is not normal. Everyone has been saying that. 30-year veterans who are up there fighting the fires that are mostly contained now have said this was not a normal fire. So again, that's 4 to 6 p.m. at the Village at Corte Madera. Drive up and donate. Also here at Dominican, there's been a response team, faculty and staff can contact Sarita Paris at Sarita, S-A-R-I-T-A dot Paris, P-U-R-E-C-E at Dominican.edu. To be part of that Dominican response team. So thank you all for joining us here at Take Back Radio. You're listening to Dominican Radio 102.3 FM or radio.dominican.edu. I'm Barbara McVeigh, and we'll catch you next time. Thank you again.